Greetings to everyone here, L'chol HaMazinim. Welcome to the Great Decisions, Part 19. The settlement, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, with Ilan Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. The War of Independence, Melchemet HaShichrur, left Israel in a truncated state with barely defensible borders, and the biblical heartland of Israel, Judea, Samaria, and the old city of Yerushalayim, occupied by Jordan, Ramat HaGolan by Syria, and Gaza ruled by Egypt. Jordan, as you know, had to change its name. Countries don't often change their names, so I guess the Congo did. But Jordan did as well, from Transjordan, because since it now occupied land on the west bank of the Jordan, both sides of the river, Trans meant the other side of the river, so they just they became Jordan, but their occupation was only recognized by two countries, Britain and Pakistan. It's a good trivia question, by the way. It was not recognized by the world. Now, the great triumph of the Six-Day War gave Israel some breathing space from a security perspective, but did something else as well. It restored the land of Israel in its entirety to Jewish sovereignty for the first time in well over 2,000 years. In a sense, not since the era of the first Beit HaMikdash did the Jewish people exercise sovereign rights over the extent of the land of Israel that they did after the Six-Day War. And the question immediately arose, what to do with this new land? What happened was not accidental, but certainly not planned. The settlement of Yehudah, Shomron, and Gaza with Jews still enrages almost every Arab, Jew haters across the world, even some putative friends, and many Israelis. But I have no doubt that but for the settlements, a Palestinian state would have been established decades ago, and that the state of Israel would no longer exist in its current form. So how the settlements came to be, who decided, how, why, that is our subject tonight. So, what to do with the new land? What would we do with it? What do most conquerors do? They annex it permanently. Annex it to the state of Israel. Something that the norms of war would certainly endorse. After all, this is not foreign territory, but the heartland of Israel. Americans will certainly recognize how the United States steadily increased its territorial reach through a number of wars and skirmishes in the 19th century until the entire land between the oceans was under American sovereignty. That's what was called the manifest destiny of the 19th century. But if any nation had a manifest destiny, and quite literally it is in the Tanakh, it would be Israel. America's manifest destiny was a pure fabrication. Israel's was found in the very Bible that Western man cherished. So annexation would have been natural. Unfortunately, that was the road not taken, except in a very limited sense. The cabinet voted already in June 1967 to surrender everything to Egypt and Syria, but the vote was 10-9. It was razor thin, and that would foreshadow events in the years after that. Yesha and Yerushalayim were excluded from that magnanimous offer. Within 3 days after the war ended in 1967, the plaza in front of the Kotel was razed, the houses torn down, the Arab residents of what was called the Moroccan Quarter were expelled, and the Kotel was then ready for the tens of thousands of Jews who visited the first Shavuos just a week later. It was the quickest urban renewal project in history, less than a week. On June 27, 1967, Israel incorporated about 70 square kilometers of Yerushalayim, of the surrounding areas, into the city, applying Israeli law to that territory and informally annexing it, but not formally so. They could already deal with the pressure coming from the Americans, the UN, the Europeans, etc., that they didn't annex it. In effect, they did. The application of law is tantamount to annexation, but they did not declare it an annexation. Now, none of this was simple, even at the very beginning. Eshkol was the prime minister, Dayan, the defense minister, were at odds. The cabinet, as we saw, was split. There were different officials. including for the IDF, Rechavam Ze'evi, Gandhi, who were drawing different maps, what should be kept, what shouldn't be kept. And some doves, like Abba Ibn, urged that nothing be done to spare Israel, that is to say, spare himself, diplomatic pressure. By the end of June, when the British Foreign Secretary insisted at the UN that no changes be made to Yerushalayim, that's when Israel formally announced the expansion of Yerushalayim. But after much agonizing, leaving Kever Rachel out and leaving some Arab villages out as well, and it was done all to preclude a forced and hasty withdrawal, such as you recall occurred after the 1956 Sinai War. Formal annexation would only come in 1980 under Menachem Begin, called Chok Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim Law, that declared Yerushalayim the complete and united capital of Israel and stipulated in Clause 6, I quote, "No authority that is stipulated in the law of the State of Israel or of the Jerusalem municipality may be transferred either permanently or for an allotted period of time to a foreign body, whether political, governmental, or to any other similar type of foreign body." How can they then be discussing the fate of Yerushalayim today? Well, it's very simple. That prohibits the transfer of any part of Yerushalayim to any foreign body, but of course it's reversible by a Knesset vote of 61 members. So even annexation is not permanent, at least in an Israeli context. There's always a loophole. Within months after June, the Jews began resettling the Jewish quarter of the Old City, from which they'd been expelled in May 1948. The Arab squatters were summarily ejected. It was a much simpler time. You just couldn't get away with that today. And Eshkol gave the order. And his order, as was his wont, was to build and build, but say nothing. Facts on the ground would speak for themselves. As it is, only one country recognized Israel's annexation of Yerushalayim in 1980. That country is? Very good. The great state of Costa Rica. We owe them a debt of gratitude to this day, the only country that recognizes it. And the people also spoke. July 1967, a poll showed that 71% of Israelis favored retaining Judea and Samaria, 91% Yerushalayim, 85% the Golan, but only half cared about Sinai. And yet by the tens of thousands, Jews began enjoying the living space, traversing the biblical land of Israel and even hiking through Sinai. And Jews soon returned to other places from which they'd been expelled in 1948, especially Gush Etzion, 10 minutes south of Yerushalayim. The Gush had fallen on Yom Ha'atzmaut, 1948. It was not an unequivocally happy day. Almost all of its defenders were massacred on that day, some taken captive by the Jordanians, held over a year. They fought heroically, indirectly. They helped Yerushalayim survive by diverting the attention of the Jordanian legion, but the Gush was gone, and for 19 years, there was only one oak tree planted by the founders that was visible to the few survivors and the descendants looking from southern Yerushalayim. In September 1967, the government decided, after much deliberation, to allow the survivors' children to rebuild Kfar Etzion, and within a few years, new settlements sprang up around them, Rosh Tzurim, Alon Shvut, and others. It was a fairly easy decision by the Eshkol government once it was made. They were pressed by people who would later play leading roles in the settlement movement, including Hanan Porat, Zichron Levracha, who died just 2 years ago at a young age. Hanan Porat, who had fought in the liberation of Yerushalayim. In fact, he was wounded in the Yom Kippur War. He was miraculously saved. An Egyptian mortar bounced off his shoulder and didn't explode. Hanan Porat was a child of one of the early Gush Etzion families, and Ranan Weitz as well, in a position in the settlement division of the government. Today the Etzion block, after all is said and done, comprises almost 25,000 souls. Porat, Hanan Porat, from July, the next few months, was relentless, but he chose to work with the government. to the north of Yerushalayim, Neve Yaakov, from which Jews had also fled in 1948, also was resettled soon after. Similar to Gush Etzion, I have to mention it, but treated differently, was Kfar Darom in the Gaza Strip in Gush Katif. Kfar Darom was built, almost the same story as Gush Etzion. Kfar Darom was built in the 1930s on land purchased by a Jew named Tuvia Miller. It was a farming community, religious kibbutzniks. They settled and survived there amid great hardship, with the Arabs constantly setting fire to their orchards. In the spring of 1948, they fought valiantly against the Egyptian invaders, but they had to abandon their land on July 8, 1948, during the War of Independence, without any food or weapons left, sneaking out, literally sneaking out in the dead of night with their few wounded, carrying only the Sifrei Torah that they used. It was decided to abandon them, not to defend them, just a few miles away, a few miles to the north. The secular kibbutz Yad Mordechai was defended to the death. And there they survived, able to retain their possession. Kfar Darom's rebuilding did not come as easily. The IDF formed a Nahal settlement there in 1970 at Golda Meir's insistence. Arabs, of course, had done absolutely nothing to the land in the 19 years they occupied it. But Kfar Darom was not formally revived as a civilian settlement until 1989. And it was to be short-lived, unfortunately, destroyed by Israel and Ariel Sharon's government in 2005. Those were the exceptions. The government adopted a policy almost immediately that anything except Yerushalayim was negotiable. They would not surrender all of Judea Samaria, but nonetheless, they would make a deal if they could. And as we know, there were no Arab takers. But there was a movement begun almost overnight, from the grassroots, to accept with gratitude the gift given to the Jewish people. And that group was not Gush Emunim. That group was HaTnu'ah Leman Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, the movement for the greater land of Israel. So right after the Six-Day War, July 1967, a movement arose naturally, even spontaneously, that had tremendous influence on Israeli society, even though its practical accomplishments were minimal. The Tnuah called immediately for the annexation of all lands conquered, except for half of Sinai. They said they felt they could return that to Egypt in exchange for a full peace. After all, why would the victor in a war return to the enemy all the bases from which the enemy launched his aggression? That policy makes no sense, because it makes war into a no-fault, no-risk proposition for the aggressor. No sane mind would ever consider it. Of course, that's what the UN adopted that October. Who was involved in that group? And therein lies its uniqueness and its initial impact on Israel. It was composed almost exclusively of secularists, but famous names, writers, poets, men of letters, generals of the IDF, people associated with the right wing, but still part of the mainstream of Israeli society, and left wing as well. Poets like Nathan Alterman and Uri Tzvi Greenberg, writers like Shai Agnon, just won the Nobel Prize a year earlier, 1966, Yitzhak Zuckerman, famed for his role in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, Rachel Ben Tzvi, widow of the previous president, the socialist Yitzhak Tabenkin, the Irgunist and friend of Menachem Begin, Shmuel Katz, Isser Harel, the founder of Mossad, then in retirement, Yisrael Eldad, one of the leaders of the Lehi, one rabbi, Reb Moshe Tzvi Neria, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the founder of Bnei Akiva. And the organization was headed by retired general Avram Yaffe, who had just fought to serve the reserves during the Six-Day War. What an eclectic group. Part of the problem of modern Israel is that it is unfathomable that such a group could be assembled today. And one reason for that is the utter demise of the secular nationalist. Just doesn't really exist anymore. Another is the strength of the religious Zionists that no longer perceive themselves as adjuncts to the leaders, but as leaders or potential leaders themselves. So So atnuah leman eretz Yisrael shleima. This was their manifesto. Nitzchono shel tzal b'mechemet sheshet hayamin, the victory of tzal in the Six-Day War. Ha'emid et ha'am amdina b'toch tkufa chadashav chotechet doral. Place the people and the state in a new and fateful period. Eretz Yisrael shleima hi atah bidei ha'am ha'yudi. The complete land of Israel is now in the hands of the Jewish people. Kishem she'ein lana reshut levater al medina Yisrael. Just like we cannot renounce the state of Israel, kach mitzuvim anu lekayem et ma shekibalnu miyadeh et Eretz Yisrael. So too we're commanded to develop, strengthen what has been placed in our hands, the land of Israel as well. And they continued in their mission statement, we are bound to be loyal to the entirety of the country for the sake of the people's past as well as its future. And no government in Israel is entitled to give up this entirety, which represents the inherent and inalienable right of our people from the beginnings of its history. Now note, there's nothing about God, or about Torah, or about the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, settling the land of Israel. The new situation was addressed in purely secular terms, but, and this is important, with a pride in Jewish identity, in the role and destiny of the Jewish people. Old-time Likudniks still speak like that, but it's hard to take them seriously, since when they come to power, they forget all about it. But the idea of a secular nationalist on the left of the Israeli political spectrum, that has already disappeared for a few decades now. Hatznuah, the movement began its public activity almost immediately, but it limited itself to pressure, to lobbying, education. Their slogan in 1969 was Hitnachalut La'altar, settlement immediately. For the most part, it didn't happen, but the idea was alive. There'd be three other events that would serve as catalysts for the emergence of an organized settlement movement. And the first was this. The movement announced its opposition to any withdrawal, certainly preliminary ones. But the United Nations passed in October of that year Resolution 242 that called upon the parties to the conflict, it's parties, no, it's states, there's no such thing yet as a Palestinian people, to negotiate a just and lasting peace within secure and recognized boundaries. And it said, in pertinent part, I quote, emphasizing the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war and the need to work for a just and lasting peace in which every state in the area can live in security, continued, that should include a number of clauses, withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. As we know, much was made of the lack of a definite article. It doesn't say the occupied territories, but from territories occupied, not from the territories occupied. That's the life of a diplomat. They spent weeks arguing over a definite article, which in fact has significance here. The point was debated vigorously. The text was fought over. This was Israel's interpretation. And the English text that lacked the definite article was the controlling one. Notwithstanding, the Arabs since then looked to the French text, which does have a definite article. Nonetheless, this resolution, November 22nd, 1967, was passed, enshrined the execrable and unworkable concept of land for peace. Israel would have to surrender the tangible in exchange for promises of the abstract. When Resolution 242 was enacted, so the Tenuah leaped into action, because they saw now the pressure on Israel would increase. Something else happened. The UN resolution did not come about in a vacuum. Once the Israeli government decided the annexation would not happen, the question then was, well, what would happen, or what should happen? 1 month after the war, Yigal Alon was the Minister of Labor, former general, longtime Labor Party official, submitted a plan to the cabinet that called for surrendering to Jordan about two-thirds of Judea and Samaria. All the land north of Yerushalayim would be returned, encompassing all the cities from Ramallah to Jenin, from west, Kalkilia, Tulkarim, and except for Gush Etzion, all the land south, including Bethlehem and Hebron. Under Alon's plan, Israel would retain the Jordan Valley. See how ironic. He saw it as indispensable to security, and now they're just... Israel would retain the Jordan Valley and a corridor right north of Yerushalayim connecting the Jordan Valley to the rest of Israel. By the same token, the Arab sector would have a corridor, including Jericho, that connected it to Jordan. Now, there's a pella here. It's astonishing. He completely ignored the narrowness of the center of Israel, which is 9 miles wide at Netanya, that had rendered Israel vulnerable and would again, under Alon's plan, become Arab. The plan was never accepted, even by the cabinet, but it never died. In truth, the current Kerry plan is barely distinguishable from the Alon plan, except for the fact that it has to take into account the settlements in Yudan Shomron, and now that the Jordan Valley is back on the table, so now it's completely different. Nothing happened to the Alon plan. His own United Kibbutz movement opposed it. Those were the days of the secular Israelis who had a mystical love for Eretz Yisrael. But nothing came of it except for this, which has been a constant since the Six-Day War. Israel persistently negotiates with itself. And every time it suggests a concession, that concession, whether made or not, is done. Because now they have north, south of Yerushalayim, along the Jordan Valley. It's still in existence. And so it's regurgitated decade after decade. More importantly, interesting in this context, Dayan opposed the Alon plan. He was a rival of Alon anyway, but he favored an Israeli presence on the mountain ridges rather than in the Jordan Valley, which is the exact opposite of Alon. But, in fact, Yigal Alon became one of the biggest champions of settlement in the Meir cabinet. It's the third event that happened, which really was a catalyst, and that was the Yom Kippur War. So for sure, the Six-Day War, after the Six-Day War, there were many who endowed that glorious victory with messianic overtones. And who's to say they're wrong? Shivat Zion really had reached its apex in terms of land. Kibbutz Goliot was on the horizon, the Soviet Jewry had been awakened, and even the Mafdal began to be permeated by a group that called itself the Young Guard, Zvulun Hammer and others, not willing to be deferential to the Labor Party rulers, aspiring to national leadership, which they never attained. But the theory was, and it's been revived again with Bayit HaYehudi, they just don't want to be the spiritual mashgichim in the kitchen of the socialist state, but rather they want to be real Jewish leaders. And most of them were guided and inspired by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Many of the settler leaders had learned in his yeshiva, Merkaz HaRav, and they were receptive to his message that the land of Israel had to be physically and not just militarily redeemed. And in a real sense, they felt very strongly that the Yom Kippur War marked the official death of secular Zionism. It was time to act. And their starting point was always, and is until this day, the Ramban on the Sefer Mitzvahs of the Rambam. So we know the Rambam wrote a Sefer Mitzvahs, who lists all of Tayag. The Ramban had his hasagos, he commented, he critiqued the Rambam's choice of mitzvos, both ase, los ase, and then he has an appendix to the Rambam Sefer Mitzvos, printed together now, called Mitzvos Sheshachach Oson Harav, mitzvos that the Rambam forgot about, but should be there, and the fourth of those mitzvos, Shenitztavinu Loreshes Haaretz, Asher Nasan Akel Yisbarach V'Yisayelo Lavoseinu Avram Yitzhak V'Yaakov. The mitzvah is a positive commandment of Torah. Of course, he takes another one out, not part of the Taryag. We're commanded to inherit the land, conquer the land that God gave to our forefathers. We cannot leave any part of it in the hands of alien people, the other nations, or lishmama, desolate. It's as much a mitzvah to conquer the land as it is to plant a tree on the land. And that's the pasuk Varashim Esarts V'Shaftim Ba, should conquer the land and dwell therein. Ki lachem nasati aretz varashas osa visnachaltem esarets shelo yanichu mimena makom. There could be no part of the land that is left without Jewish settlement. The Ramban continues, you shouldn't think that this mitzvah just applies to the war of the seven kings where they entered the land of Israel. Ein adavar kein. Shanistavenu laharog umo sahemi l'chamam imanu. We're commanded to kill the nations that stopped us from conquering the land. Imratzu lashlim nashlimi mahem. If you want to make peace with us, fine. We can leave them in the land of Israel under certain parameters. Aval ha'aretz lo naniach hasa biyadam v'lo biyad zulasam in ha'umos v'dor min adoros. Ramban says a permanent mitzvah on Jews. We cannot leave any part of the land of Israel in the hands of non-Jews, any other nation, at any time in our history. V'dor min adoros. So to Rav Kook and his disciples, settlement was the fulfillment of a mitzvah asay min haTorah, according to Ramban, a positive commandment, daraisa, and as well the fulfillment of the mitzvah that would define their generation. One of Rav Kook's prime disciples was Rav Moshe Levinger, he's nearing 80 years old now, he's not healthy. Born Yerushalayim, at this time he was the Rav of Nechalim near Petach Tikva, when after the war he first helped resettle Gush Etzion, and then he decided to act on his own. It's a bit of a lone cowboy in many respects. Until this point, all settlement had taken place in areas where Jews had lived before 1948 and were not in the midst of Arab population centers. Rav Levinger endeavored to change that and hatched a scheme with a right-wing, secular, came from with his family, but now secular Tel Aviv lawyer named Eliakim Ha'etzni. In the cabinet, Yigal alone turned out to be very helpful to their project. Before Pesach 1968, Rav Levinger rented 32 rooms for the whole entourage of the Arab-owned Park Hotel in Hebron, celebrated Yom Tov there, and like the proverbial bad guest, refused to leave afterwards. So in fact, he had negotiated an open-ended stay with the owner. He refused to leave because he had decided to settle in Hebron, and he would force the issue. A moving truck came to the hotel, brought his refrigerator, his personal belongings, his clothing, brought all his sarm as well. Now remember, Hebron, of course, it had a Jewish community from time immemorial until they were massacred by the Arabs in 1929, with the survivors fleeing in 1936. So it was technically in line with Israeli policy to resettle areas where Jews had once lived. But of course the difference was, this was in the middle of an Arab city. It conflicted with that policy. Rav Levinger didn't care. But the conflict in objectives, Jews had lived there, but now it's an Arab city, led to paralysis in policy. The government debated and debated until Eshkol hinted, as he had done to others, to go forward. But without actually saying the words, he was clearly ambivalent. He visited Johnson in Texas, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Johnson asked Eshkol what his plans were for the territories, and Eshkol answered Kadarko that Israel had decided not to decide. Rav Levinger took advantage of that indecision, and he stayed and saved with his wife Miriam, a Bronx native, and their children, and many others as well. So the question is, why did the army just expel them? That expelled others, why didn't they just go in, forcibly remove them from the hotel? Strange things happened. Strange things. Hashgacha. During the week of Pesach, the military coordinator in charge of the area, an unsympathetic lefty named Shlomo Gazit, who's still around, he was vehemently against settling Jews there. Unfortunately, he suffered the loss of his father on Pesach. He was sitting Shiva when Rav Levinger stayed, and he could say nothing. Right before Pesach, the defense minister, Moshe Dayan, who was also not sympathetic, was severely injured when a cave that he was excavating collapsed on him. You all know Dayan's hobby was looting and stealing antiquities. So he did that, and the cave collapsed on him. He suffered broken ribs and a shattered larynx. He literally couldn't talk, even if he wanted to, for weeks and weeks. After the summer, they're still debating. Another critical stage, Dayan's father died, and he was sitting Shiva. So in fact, the Levingers remained in the hotel for almost 2 months until the government gave them permission to move into an army base as residents. And from there, their demands grew. The Tanua lent their weight and campaigned for a Jewish settlement in or near Hebron. Within a year, the Levinger family and friends were allowed to form what became the settlement of Kiryat Arba. By then it was 1971. 8 years later, Miriam Levinger moved into Hebron proper, to Beit Hadassah, also forcibly, also refused to be evicted, and the Jewish settlement in Hebron there was rejuvenated. Rav Levinger was a role model for the settlement movement in one way. He was Mosen Nefesh. He was singularly focused on Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. He was arrested and imprisoned many times, but he showed others that defiance of the government worked. And so he had these two models in the settlement movement. One was Rav Levinger's defy the government, push them beyond their capabilities. And the other was Hanan Parat, work with the government to the extent possible. But nothing else happened after Kiryat Arba was settled, and then the Yom Kippur War came. So as noted, it was discussed a few weeks ago, the war was a shock to the Israeli psyche. The initial losses of land, the terrible death toll, the international pressure after the war to start withdrawing from Sinai more, start withdrawing from the Golan. Rav Kook and his followers saw the setbacks as a divine message. Either settle the land or lose it. The Torah and Jewish destiny required that the land of Israel be sanctified. And that meant that Jews would dwell on the land, farm the land, exercise sovereignty over the land, possess the land, literally. They received the impetus to work quickly when in 1974, new Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, when the Rabin government succeeded Golda Meir, Rabin came under tremendous pressure, to which he succumbed, to surrender parts of the Golan and later parts of Sinai. The Kissinger disengagement talks. At Rav Kook's initiative, his Talmidim formed an organization called Gush Emunim, the block of the faithful, name given to them by Rav Chaim Drukman, shall live and be well, in February 1974. Rav Levinger was involved, as was many people, many famous names that still resonate in our world today. Rav Shlomo Aviner, still living then on the Golan, within a few years moved to Beit El. One of the great leaders, the real dynamo, was Hanan Parat. Also deeply involved, Rav Eliezer Waldman, who then himself went to live in Kiryat Arba, Rav Yaakov Ariel, today the chief rabbi of Ramat Gan, and many, many more. Others, part of the movement in the beginning, later turned on the movement in a sense, and went their own way. Rav Menachem Froman just died last year, became a real leftist, the chief rabbi of Tekoa. Yoel Ben Nun, by the 1990s, they were leaning left. Gush Emunim not only formed a bloc to settle the land of Israel, but they became a powerful, dominant force within the Mafdal, the National Religious Party, what would become a difficult and at times chaotic and unpleasant association. Gush Emunim went to work in 1974. They joined together with another group that had already begun to agitate for Jewish settlement in the heart of Samaria, north of Yerushalayim. The hope was to fulfill the mitzvah, and especially, at the same time, to thwart any plans to withdraw from the land. There may be withdrawals in the Golan and the Sinai, but they would see to it there'd be no withdrawals anywhere else. A Palestinian state then was not even on the horizon. A byproduct was the enhanced security that would come as a result of increased settlement. So, take a detour for a moment and ask a very simple question. Why did anyone oppose settlement? Why would Jews in the land of Israel, official, unofficial, political leaders, civilians, why would anyone want to oppose the right of Jews to settle in the heartland of the Jewish state? You want to answer the question? There's always an answer. There are two reasons, usually but not always, attracting the same people. The first, I call the peaceniks. In retrospect, it sounds crazy, but there were Israelis who bought into the land for peace equation. That all the Arabs wanted was their land back, and then, having been defeated in war, they would live in peace with Israel. The Israeli cabinet, under international pressure, I know you're laughing, it's funny, it actually embraced this, but Eshel, to his credit, never acted upon it. Here and there, the Arabs offered non-belligerency, but that didn't suffice for him. Nevertheless, it was a powerful illusion that seized, still seizes, the imagination of the left, including diplomats, and especially Abba Ibn, who opposed all settlements, even as he opposed the return to the 1967 armistice lines. What makes it such an obvious delusion, so you wonder what they were thinking at the time, is that on June 4th, 1967, the Arab-Israeli conflict was not based on land. There was no occupation, and there were no settlements. The issue was Israel's existence, period. So why then would they think that on June 12th, just 7, 8 days later, all of a sudden the conflict boiled down to land? And if the land was returned, peace would come. Certainly the diplomats, many hostile to Israel, were pushing that line, but essentially it was a figment of their imagination, and still is. Along these lines, peaceniks maintained that they did not want to rule over a million Arabs, that such would debilitate the soul of Israel. It's fascinating that that argument emerged within weeks after the Six-Day War from the pen of a young Amos Oz, and he's never retreated from it. Now, 47 years, almost 47 years later, he has yet to grasp that there are nations and people in his vicinity who want to kill him and destroy his country, but he and his fellow travelers have done more than anyone else to foster the climate in the world that's hostile to Israel and promote the chimera that the dispute is all about land. One group were the peaceniks. The second group that I call the legalists. The second reason focused on the alleged illegality of settlement. So early on, Eshkol in secret commissioned the foreign ministry to render a decision on the legality of settlement in light of the Fourth Geneva Convention. A top secret memorandum was submitted to him by the foreign minister's legal counsel, Theodore Meron, who was born in Poland in 1930. We share a birthday, April 28th. After Meron, to show you where he's coming from and where he went, after he left the foreign ministry, since then, almost 25, 30 years now, he's worked at the UN. Today, he's in his 80s, but he still serves as the president of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the presiding judge for appeals of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, a war crimes judge, but an international diplomat. Not surprisingly, Meron ruled that Jewish settlement in Yesha violated the Fourth Geneva Convention, which states, I quote, that an occupier may not forcibly deport protected persons or deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into occupied territory, end quote. So he wrote that Israel would be in explicit contravention of this international law. Did he have to rule that way? No. And this issue has been debated endlessly for decades. So think about it. The convention was designed, came after World War II, it was designed to thwart aggressive countries from conquering, occupying other countries, and depopulating their conquests. In other words, the nations should not do what the Nazis did, for example. Conquer Poland, deport and or murder the local population, and then send Germans to live there. But Poland was an independent sovereign state. Was it the same here? No. There was no recognized sovereign in the area. Jordan's occupation of Dan Shomron was never recognized internationally, nor was Egypt's in Gaza. And Israel was not an aggressor like Germany, but was fighting a defensive war, which it won. So what sense does a convention make, and how can it apply to this situation? Again, it would mean there's no downside to being an aggressor. If you win, you win. And if you lose, so the winner has to return the territory back to you. What sense does that make? Besides, this wasn't foreign land, but a land that was an integral part of the biblical land of Israel, which Jews had claimed in the negotiations before the state. Some of it was just lost in the war of 1948, and many places where Jews had already settled. There are other legal scholars, unfortunately overwhelmed by the majority, Israeli, American, European, who define Yesha as, I quote, unallocated territories from the British Mandate. Meaning Israel had had two recognized, or the land had had two recognized sovereigns going back to the 16th century. The Ottoman Empire, then the British Empire. But once the British left, there was no recognized sovereign. And therefore, they maintained Israel's claim to the land was as good, if not stronger, than any Arab claim. It's not occupied territories, it's disputed territories, as Israel called it for decades until recently, administered territories. And the Arabs rejected the UN partition. So certainly no such thing as a Palestinian entity that had any claims. That would come much later, 1988. This, what I just said, was the assertion of Eugene Rostow, the former dean of the Yale Law School, and at the time was Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs in 1967, but his conclusion did not convince his own State Department, much less the world. I don't think he convinced the Israelis, frankly, but it's a good argument. Settlement can't be illegal because Israel had captured the land from an illegitimate occupier, to wit, Jordan. It bears mention as well that this Fourth Geneva Convention is not Torah Sinai, and in the 65 years since its adoption, it seems to have been applied only to Israel and to no other country that's occupied other lands like Russia, like Tibet. So it's more polemical than real, but it certainly has influenced Israelis on the left. Eshkol himself ignored it. He took the memorandum from their own, stuck it in the desk drawer, and under color of legality, he did it. Under the convention, and of course you would have hoped that there would be more honesty about it, but such is not always life. Under the convention, remember the words, only the civilian population cannot be transferred and live in the conquered lands, but the military can establish bases. And that's what Eshkol ordered. Every settlement, starting with Gush Etzion, two in the Jordan Valley, north and south of the Dead Sea, the new settlement in the Golan, even Kiryat Arba, they were declared to be IDF Nachal settlements. And that's how Eshkol sold it domestically and internationally, and that's how the labor government, divided as they were, became the early, albeit reluctant, supporters of Jewish settlement. And each success convinced the settlers that it was a Ratzon Hashem that they fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, exactly as Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook taught. In the cabinet, the tablet was divided, but again, it's like this, each person had their own agenda. Yisrael Galili, for example, another staunch veteran laborite, he helped found Male Adumim and later Yamit, but the move to the heartland still awaited and would gain steam as Israelis felt increased pressure to surrender land to Jordan. So how did the move to Samaria happen? And this event is really the focus tonight, to the next few minutes. Already in 1973, building on Rav Levinger's success, a garin formed, including Hanan Parat, another famous name, Daniela Weiss, that tried to settle near Shechem, what would years later become Elon Moreh. But the government twice obstructed their efforts. This small group then linked up with Gush Emunim and proved to be relentless and unstoppable, helped of course by turmoil in the government. In June 1974, a new government was formed. Yitzhak Rabin was the prime minister. His nemesis, Shimon Peres, was the defense minister. They always acted at cross purposes. that would aid the settlers. Already in June, Benny Katzover, Rav Menachem Felix, Nebuch's daughter, was killed during the war for the land of Israel in the early 2000s. And others, they planned to encamp at Elon Moreh. Rav Kook was ambivalent. Should they defy the government? But only when Peres said he was supportive, but they should wait, Rav Kook gave the go-ahead. They arrived in a convoy, including Rav Kook, long black coat, big hat, white beard. They pitched tents, barbed wire fence, army came, confrontation ensued. Who came to help them? Help the settlers? A hero of the Yom Kippur War, then a fledgling member of Knesset from Likud, who had been instrumental in assembling the new Likud party, one Ariel Sharon. Within a few hours, the government agreed to have them move to an army base, and Rav Kook refused, asking repeatedly, what's wrong with this place? And every time the general said, no, we have to move, army base, he would say, what's wrong with this place? It's also Eretz Yisrael. By nightfall, the army received orders to evacuate the settlers. There was mild resistance. Sharon stepped into the fray, screaming for soldiers, some of whom had served with him in Sinai, to refuse orders. Refuse orders! Refuse to evict Jews! Sharon cried, this is an immoral order! How ironic is that? It was the first of several attempts they would make to settle the area. So the settlers were able to exploit the weakness of the government. Remember that Rabin was not elected prime minister. He had formed the government after Golda Meir resigned. So he needed the votes of the Mafdal to maintain the government. And of course, even ironically, Gush Emunim would soon sever its formal ties with the Mafdal. And Rabin also did not want to alienate any voters for the next election. That would be his first election, which actually never came because he couldn't run in 77. And so too was a lack of trust between the three who ran the government. A complete lack of trust between Rabin and Peres and Yigal Alon, who was the foreign minister. Henry Kissinger wrote in his memoirs, I quote, Rabin trusted Alon's character far more than his intelligence. With Peres, it was exactly the opposite. He trusted his intelligence, but not his character. And with Rabin already withdrawing in Sinai and Golan, he had no interest, for political reasons, in surrendering any land to Jordan. Now, Kissinger pushed and threatened, both in the north and the south, and in Yudan Shomron. Remember, it was the year of the reassessment, so-called reassessment of U.S.-Israel relations, followed by intense shuttle diplomacy, it's 1975, intended in part to distract the American public from the fall of Saigon in April 1975 and the defeat in Vietnam. Right? The same thing today, really. There are no problems in the world. You know, Fallujah did not just fall to Al-Qaeda. There's no problem in north of Iraq, no problem in Syria, Egypt, anywhere else. Kerry is in Israel. Kissinger was the same way. To detract from foreign policy failures, you go to the place where you think you will be able to wring concessions out of a weak leadership. So even though he was not planning withdrawing from Yudan Shomron, Rabin was still reluctant to allow the development of Yesha. Gush Emunim met with him again about Elon Moreh, and Rabin said, I quote, if you think the government is going to follow the lunacy of a few dozen Jews, you're mistaken. To which Rav Felix responded, in that case, you'll meet hundreds of Jews, right? Not a few dozen. For religious Zionists, it became a project. A source of pride, the youth got involved, and a way to make a lasting contribution to Jewish destiny. 1974, 1975, 8 attempts were made to establish outposts in the Shomron. Plans were made to start what became Ofra, Shiloh, and others, and all as IDF bases of one kind or another. By late spring, Ofra had become what was called a temporary work camp for army employees, even though not a one of them worked for the army. That 30 people, duly authorized by Shimon Peres. But elsewhere, 7 attempts failed when Rabin ordered the army to scatter them and destroy their flimsy structures. But with each attempt, public support grew, media attention added to the ranks of the settlers. Failures were perceived as temporary, successes became permanent, and part of this was Rav Kook's genius and passion. that he said, do not be discouraged when something is torn down, we'll rebuild it. In fact, one attempt during the summer, Rav Kook told the new settlers they could drink on Tisha B'Av in the heat of their encampment. The Yishuv Eretz Yisrael took precedence over the fast. And the eighth attempt to establish a civilian settlement succeeded, and remarkably so. It was December 1975, it was Hanukkah. A large group of settlers again took over an abandoned railway station in the ancient town of Sebastia, not far from Shechem. The spot was chosen by Sharon. They refused to leave. And they were joined by Knesset members, including Menachem Begin, by the poets and writers from Hatznuah, by hundreds and hundreds of students and young people. Hundreds of people hiked to the site, dodging army checkpoints. Rabin's response was very complicated. His rival Peres was trying to find a way for the settlers to stay and to distinguish himself from Rabin for, again, electoral purposes. And Rabin had now appointed himself an advisor on defense matters, someone who would keep an eye on Peres and boost his own bona fides with the right wing. Who did he appoint? Ariel Sharon left the Knesset as a Likud member to become Rabin's advisor on defense matters because Rabin simply did not trust Peres. Here, Rabin blamed Peres, the defense minister, for not stopping the masses from coming to Sebastia. And the government was paralyzed, not knowing how to react, both for political and ideological reasons. No Arabs were being displaced. The land of Israel was being resettled, fulfilling the dream of Zionism. After all, this was the homeland of the Jewish people. And with the PLO now officially recognized in the UN as the representative of the Palestinian people, Jewish weakness and hesitation were perceived as strengthening the hands of the enemy. I remember the period very well because I was in Israel at the time learning, and we had long discussions in the yeshiva whether we should participate, because the bulk of the 3,000 people who eventually came to Sebastia were students from yeshivas are off during Hanukkah week. And I remember having long discussions, and if I remember correctly, Moshe Rabbeim urged us to go. Rabbi Rakefa urged us to go. The one dissenting vote was Nechama Leibowitz, who said we should not go because she feared a war would break out as a result and that we Americans would not be the ones to fight it, so why should we precipitate it? That was her argument, if I recall correctly. I decided not to go, and then I decided to go. And then I got the flu. So I wound up spending a week in bed in Hanukkah, and everyone else was gone, which just as well, because part of the story is, while they were there Hanukkah, it rained for days, and they all came back completely muddy. You know, they didn't bring change of clothing, filled with mud, and many of them sick as well. As many as 3,000 Jews had gathered in Sebastia. The general in charge of Central Command joined the settlers for Shabbos. They honored him, he made Kiddush. Naomi Shemer came, read her new song about Eretz Yisrael belonging to Am Yisrael. On Sunday, Peres landed in a military helicopter, and as the story was reported, he was surrounded by settlers, as one author put it, like the groom at a wedding. When Rabin decided to send in 5,000 troops to evict the settlers from Sebastia, the chief of staff, Mota Gur, wanted no part of it. Enraging Rabin, he didn't want to play the role of Rabin at Altalena. And he said he had no interest and would not participate. A compromise was offered. Some settlers could remain at a nearby army post. That's how it was started. As happened frequently, a dispute broke out between Rav Levinger and Rav Parat. Chanan Parat was a musmach as well. He never called himself rabbi, though. Dispute broke out whether to accept the offer or to resist. Rav Levinger always wanted to force things. And Chanan Parat, gradually. The committee voted 5-2, Gush Emunim committee, to accept the offer. The next day they negotiated the terms, further terms in Peres' office. Their initial offer they accepted was to have 30 people go to the army base. When they left Peres' office, it had become 30 families. A little different. 30 families would remain nearby, and the settlers, despite being told to leave, and leaving, announced victory. Later, Yigal alone was furious. He didn't support this area for settlement as it undermined the Alon plan. Nonetheless, Rabin threatened to resign unless the plan was accepted by the cabinet, and it was. The 30 families were placed nearby, and the settlement of Kedumim was founded. For decades, under the leadership of Daniela Weiss, Kedumim now hosts almost 5,000 souls. The die was cast. Within a short time, Ofra became official. A month and a half after that, Hanukkah, I'd recovered from the flu. Tu Bishvat, 1976, 38 years ago next week, I planted a tree at the entrance to Ofra, and now that tree must be in the middle of the town because it's expanded. Almost 4,000 Jews live there today. Later, Elon Moreh was built. A few years after that, Beit El, and many others as well. Just 2 years after this incident, in 1977, when Menachem Begin was elected the prime minister, he made his first stop at Elon Moreh, and he promised many more Elon Morehs. And under his minister of agriculture, dozens of settlements were built. That minister, of course, is Ariel Sharon. There are other legal challenges along the way, especially regarding the use of state land, the issue of state land versus private land, private Palestinian land. In October 1979, the Supreme Court ruled that Elon Moreh was illegally built on expropriated land in violation of international law. Supreme Court accepted the Geneva Convention. A heated debate broke out in Begin's cabinet in Gush Emunim across the country. There were threats. The cabinet decided to comply with the court decision. That provoked another crisis. The Mafdal threatened to resign from Begin's government. Gush Emunim threatened to resist forcibly. Then as now, the Supreme Court was held in disdain. Eventually, Elon Moreh was moved to a nearby site, larger site in fact, which still exists today, overlooking the city of Shechem, home to about 1,500 Jews. So what are the consequences of this event? The settlements really grew from decisions, but more importantly from non-decisions. In fact, our series is entitled Great Decisions. This really was a great non-decision. Because you can't ever say there was one decision to go forward. It was incremental. Things happened actively, passively, from the government's perspective, but the moving force primarily was the determined activism from a small number of dedicated Jews. And for decades, their legality, the settlement's legality, has been debated. Jimmy Carter was the first to term them illegal, an expression that was abandoned by Ronald Reagan and George Bush the Younger. They prefer to call them unhelpful, but they renounce the notion that they're illegal. Linked to this word settlement for decades has been the phrase obstacles to peace. Odd, since there was no peace even before the settlements. In Israel, they represent the best of the pioneer spirit with a love of the land of Israel that's breathtaking. The people I know, and I know many, they live with an emunah pshuta, a simple belief that they're fulfilling God's will and moving Jewish destiny forward. From a diplomatic perspective, the settlements have been a disaster, just a club with which to beat Israel constantly, but it's been also a political and security godsend. And as I started, it's undeniable if there were no settlements, there would have been a Palestinian state decades ago. Judging by the consequences of previous retreats from Sinai, now we see from Gaza, South Lebanon, part of Yudan Shomron, Israel would be surrounded by enemies, easy to invade, even easier to torment through terror. Who knows if it would still exist? People have often lamented, on the left, they've lamented the necessity to having soldiers guard, 30 people here, 70 people there. But the fact is, when you have military bases all over the area, that itself is a pervasive presence that tended to tamp down Arab expectations. Officially, Israel, except for a short time during the Begin administration, has never really deviated from Eshkol's original decision not to decide. And the settlements have been a political football for 40 years. The Labor Party that had built the initial settlements eventually turned on them with a vengeance. perceiving them as an obstacle to peace, and worse, a hotbed of their political opponents, the breed of old-time laborite who supported settlement, an Alon, a Galili, a Yitzhak Tabenkin, even a Levi Eshkol, even a Shimon Peres in that incarnation, they've all disappeared. And the red lines, Yerushalayim, Jordan Valley, 1967 borders, sadly they've all faded, and Israel's on the verge now, again, of indulging the same fantasy of land for peace that has bedeviled it since the Six-Day War. And yet most of the withdrawals have taken place under the auspices of the so-called right-wing governments, whether Begin or Sharon, Netanyahu. In effect, I coined this expression almost 15 years ago, labor proposes and Likud disposes. That's been the sad reality of Israeli political life. How is that possible? So Rav Volfman once explained to me, and I accept it to this day, he said, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a value in the Torah, but it's also a value for secular Jews. Secular Israelis, some at least. But if it was the same for both, if you could arrive at the same destination, love of the land, through the Torah, and not through the Torah, then you wouldn't need the Torah. Hence, for secular Israelis, he said, their commitment must end at a certain point. And John Kerry, as many others before him, is exploring just exactly where that point is, where commitment to Eretz Yisrael ends and fear and fantasy take over. And it's the starting point that always differs between the two groups in Israel. The secularist speaks of pressure, relentless pressure, as justification for their capitulations, and the settler looks at them with incomprehension and pity. It's the Torah. It's Eretz Yisrael. Would you succumb to pressure to change Shabbos to Sunday? Would you succumb to pressure to give your wife to another man who wants her? So what's pressure? They're not always popular, to say the least, but they've suffused an entire generation with an ethos of self-sacrifice and Avat Eretz Yisrael. But more than all that is the spirit they've given to the people in difficult times. No doubt they've endured many difficult times. As a glorious reminder of the historic era in which we are living, when the Nevi'im prophesied of our return to Israel at the end of days, they weren't talking about Tel Aviv. As Yirmiyahu said, we read this in Haftarah, second Rosh Hashanah, O titi chramim barei shomron, natu notim v'chilelu. Navi said, you will yet plant vineyards in Samaria. The planters will plant and redeem them. That prophecy has come to pass before our eyes. If only we realize it, and soon, then we'll spare ourselves a lot of additional heartache on the way to Gula Shlema, b'mehera b'yameinu, amen. I thank you all for coming. Next week.